Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Özil marca. Mesut Özil.
That is some absolutely world-class sitting down there, staying at home, just sitting down. Oh, look, there he goes. He's eaten his fourth sandwich of the day. This is remarkable.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too, Andrew. How are you doing today?
I am better than Frank Lampard, to tell you that.
Yeah, real shame. Real shame to see him go, to be honest. Felt like he was a kind of decent sort of sleeper agent manager in there who was, you know, going to limit their potential. Sadly, they have sought to amend the situation, as they usually do, in fairness to Chelsea. They don't hang about.
No, they don't. They are ruthless as fuck, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And it looks like it's a sort of case of et tu, Petr. I think Petr Cech, it sounds like, has been involved sort of behind the scenes in bringing about Frank's demise, having sort of meetings with players. And I mean, you know, he's just doing his job, but that'll sting for Frank.
Whoa, okay. Yeah, Petr Cech. You wouldn't put him down as the kind of ruthless, behind the scenes, slip the dagger in, hatchet man kind of guy. Can you slip a dagger in with a hatchet? I don't know if that's the thing, but maybe there's a dark side to Petr Cech that we just don't know about.
What's he hiding beneath that helmet? I imagine, by the way, that he still wears that, like, in his new job as technical director.
Isn't there a brilliant it could be from one of the FIFA games where when you're playing manager mode or whatever it is, and Petr Cech was still a player, and you go in to do contract negotiations with Petr Cech, and he's sitting there in the manager's office with his agent wearing the helmet.
I'm sure that's accurate.
I'm pretty sure There's a picture of it somewhere. Petr Cech, FIFA helmet, which could bring up some unfortunate results. But no, yeah, there it is. If you Google Petr Cech, FIFA helmet, his agent is saying, "Now, come on, let's get to the issue of contract length." And Petr Cech is sitting there looking at him with his helmet on
and a tie. It's the combination of helmet and tie that really sets it off.
There you go.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, sad to see Frank Lampard go before we even really got to enjoy the spoils of Lampard out, you know, to the full extent.
Yeah, I mean, we never were in a position to do it properly, you know. We weren't in any sort of state ourselves to be crowing or to be, you know, mocking other managers when, you know, things weren't going as well for us as we would have liked. So it just didn't quite feel right to do it. I you know, it is an opportunity missed. There you go. I mean, maybe we can blame Mikel Arteta for this in some ways. Do better, Mikel Arteta, and we would have had a chance to do some Lampard out for the listeners. So well, there you go. There's a black mark on Arteta's card right now.
Absolutely. And we've only ourselves to blame for Lampard sacking, because, you know, that game against Chelsea really did swing their fortunes pretty dramatically.
Yeah, and of course he did. You know, he came out and sort of blamed the players. And from then on, I'm sure his situation was increasingly precarious anyway, but when you come out and you kind of put the blame on the players straight away, yeah, you're toast. You're toast from then on.
Yeah, there were some warning signs. Also, you know, he had fair enough, but he had a pop at my colleague at The Athletic, Liam Twomey, who'd written a very critical piece about his Chelsea tenure. Yeah, he sort of was like, oh, well, I've read some of the pieces. If the players read what you're writing, you know, how negative it is, they'd be really down. As soon as a manager starts, manager is, of course, entitled to engage with criticism, but I think it's often a very, very bad sign.
Yeah, I wonder, did Frank Lampard pay full price for his subscription to The Athletic, or did he get one of those like €1 a month deals, which
sure
I see everywhere after I paid full price, but never mind.
Think he, you know, boxed Black Friday, you know, he was there, he said, Roman, can I borrow a pound? They sorted him out. And yeah, you see, he signed up for the 12 months. Will he renew? That's the big. That's always the big question.
He's got nothing else. Renewals. Got nothing else to do at this moment.
That's true. He needs something to read.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sort of sorry to see him go, because I suspect that if a very competent, capable coach comes in, you know, there is a lot of talent in that squad.
Thomas,
to work with.
Thomas Tuchel apparently is the man.
Yes.
So there you go.
One of those names perennially linked with Arsenal jobs when they come up, you know.
Yeah.
Probably maybe less likely to happen now he's gone to the blue side. But
yeah, very, very slightly less likely to happen now that he's employed by Chelsea. Yeah. We'll just get him when he's 83.
when they don't want him anymore.
Yeah.
He's 83.
They've given him a 2-year contract. We're going to give him the 6 or 7 that he's looking for, you know.
Exactly.
So all right.
We're his pension plan.
Let's move away from all that nonsense and move on to our very own nonsense and an FA Cup defeat, a rare enough thing in recent years for Arsenal. Our defence of the trophy is over. We went out to Southampton 1-0 on Saturday at St Mary's. I know there are many layers to this, and we can discuss the lineup, the rotation, and everything else. I'm just curious as to your, you know, what is your sort of visceral reaction to losing or going out of the FA Cup? You know, beyond, above and beyond the, you know, nobody wants to see Arsenal lose a game. Was it, you know, on the pain spectrum, how far was it one way or the other?
In terms of sort of my visceral response, it annoyed me a bit more than I thought it would.
Right.
Only because I suppose I look at our Premier League season maybe somewhat unfairly as a bit of a busted flush, and so the cup competitions provided a possible allure of glory that maybe is certainly less plausible in the Premier League. And I only kind of realised that when we went out. And I was like, right, so I guess it's all about the Europa League. And you know, I know people say, well, look, we might climb the Premier League, we might squeeze into Europe via Premier League position. I just suppose that's less viscerally exciting. You know what I mean?
Sure.
What did you think? How
I'm
did you feel?
A little bit sort of not conflicted by it, but
I get it. You know, I do get it. But
yeah, I love the FA Cup, and you know, all the times we've won the FA Cup has been absolutely amazing. I just wonder what another FA Cup win would tell us. And that's not to say that I don't want to win the cup, or I was happy to see us go out or anything like that. Absolutely not. But I just wonder what another FA Cup win would tell us about this team, other than establishing ourselves as a cup team, you know, even more than we already are. You know, we've won cups in 2017, we won it in 2020. The league, I think, is the true barometer, or the thing that we can look at to really gauge the development and the progress of the team. And I know in some ways it's difficult as well because of what's happened in that run where we dropped so many points that, you know, after 38 games, it will be a true reflection of who we are as a team and what we're capable of and everything else. You know, but we're making up an awful lot of lost ground in the league. So I see the side where people say we really should have gone hard for the FA Cup because it's a trophy, because of all the reasons why winning trophies is good. We know that. But at the same time, I'm kind of more invested in what we do in the Premier League this season and where we could potentially end up. Having come through this bad spell, we may go through another really terrible spell and completely and utterly bemoan the lack of FA Cup opportunity. I get it, but I just feel like if we really want to see where we're going, it's what we do in the league week in, week out. That will be the measure of that. That will give us a lot more information about who we are, what we're capable of, where we're going, what we need to do to get there, and so on, rather than a cup run, which, you know, again, not to be in any way disrespectful or to play it down, you know, teams can go on cup runs You know, you think of Wigan, for example, getting to the final and winning the final against Man City. I think they got relegated in the same season. So, you know, it doesn't really tell you anything above and beyond that they've had a good run in the cup. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. And, you know, you're right. We've effectively sort of completed the FA Cup, really, over the last few years. We've absolutely dominated that competition. I suppose maybe it's a little bit pessimistic of me, but when I look at our upcoming fixture list in the Premier League, I wonder if people will be quite so invested in it in a 6 weeks' time or something
that. Yeah, I get that. I completely get that, you know?
Who knows? Nevertheless, I suppose it's sort of moot because I don't think Mikel Arteta, yes, he heavily rotated his team, but I don't think he threw the tie.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I saw a lot of people say that he's deliberately thrown this game, and I don't think that's... Look, I think there are questions about some of the performances, but I before the game, I, you know, was fully expecting him to rotate. He did rotate. Yeah. I could see and understand why he would do that in many cases. You know, maybe the question is more about who came in and what they did rather than the rotation itself.
Yeah, but, you know, at the end of the day, he played Leno, Holding, Bellerin, Gabriel, Xhaka, Martinelli. I mean, those are all players who have been at various points this season, you know, very at the forefront of his plans. Mm. And I think if you look at his disappointment after the game, I think this is a team he selected that he, rightly or wrongly, expected more from.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some cases wrongly.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are a couple of players who I'm sure we'll discuss who, you know, you know, there's a last chance saloon for one or two of them anyway, or certainly one of them, you know, in Willian, I think. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much more we can say about that particular player. But, you know, let's talk about the team in the sense that, you know, it was rotated. There was no Kieran Tierney. And I have to say, I was kind of glad of that from the point of view that he did 120 minutes against Newcastle, then missed the next game against Crystal Palace, and we really missed what he brings us at left back. So, you know, not playing Tierney, not playing Smith Rowe, not bringing Smith Rowe into the team at all. You know, people might be critical of that, but, you know, in a couple of weeks' time, they might think, okay, well, that was relatively smart because we still have Smith Rowe for the Premier League, a player who we are finding it difficult to operate or function properly without. You know, if Premier League points are really what's higher on your agenda than winning the cup, you can understand why that player was rested completely. So
yeah, and look at the player's history as well, you know, and how much football he's missed for different reasons. I think that's absolutely reasonable. I think we all had concerns about Tierney playing too many games. You know, I didn't have huge issues with the lineup. I understood why he chose to rest the players he did. I think it's more about the level of performance that the guys who brought in produced. You know?
What about Willian as a number 10, given he's, you know, basically never played there in his career? Is it a question that, okay, look, we don't have Smith Rowe. The only other real option that we have in the team to play there is perhaps Bukayo Saka, but you don't want to play him either because, you know, you want to keep him relatively fresh. He's played a lot of football, so you don't want to, you know, absolutely run him into the ground. You know, at a push, maybe if Danny Ceballos had been fit, you could say, well, you know, with Saka and Elneny behind, he could possibly flit around in that area. So, you know, was it a question of saying, look, he's an experienced player. I know he hasn't played there a great deal, but he understands the game. He understands what he might need to do in that situation. Is there an element of being, not saying unfair is the wrong word, but maybe expecting too much from Willian? Not simply because he isn't a player who's played at number 10 a great deal, but on the basis of what we've seen from him this season, if he cannot produce in his favoured position, where he's played his whole career on the right-hand side, he's been basically incapable of producing anything in, you know, 20 games since the opening day of the season. I know he had that assist for Gabriel. That's one cross that, you know, Gabriel headed in well. You know, is it just stupid to then play him out of position and expect anything better?
I don't know, because like you say, I'm not sure how many options we have right now in that position. Is it stupid to expect anything better?
Maybe stupid is the wrong word. You know what I mean? But is it just being overly optimistic or just kind of saying, well, look, it might work. Let's give it a bash. Or is it a case simply that he's just got nothing else to try in that area of the pitch?
I think it's about not having a lot of options in that area of the pitch. And I think it's also for Willian about just trying something different. And I completely appreciate that it didn't work either. But I can understand why he might think, you know, what if we change the problem slightly for Willian? What if we change his perspective? What can we try and refresh him in some fashion? And I know that it's an idea that's derided, but I mean, I do think a lot of wide creative players end up in central positions. I don't think it's, you know, there's not no precedent for that. I mean, it happens. And ultimately, Arsenal have got Willian under contract till he's 34. And I can tell you one thing, he won't be playing on the wing at 34. So if Arsenal are serious about trying to make this work, I honestly don't think you can really consider him as a winger in the long term. You know, I think maybe you've got this season out of him most in that position. I mean, it's very, very rare to find players age.
Yeah, but then what is he now? If he's not a winger, what is he? If he's not a central player either, you know, what is he? What benefit is he? What can he bring to this team? You know, if we've got Smith Rowe that we're wrapping in cotton wool because he's so important, and we're bringing in Martin Ødegaard from Real Madrid to provide some competition / backup, you know, what is...
Well, Willian won't get a game in that position then, I wouldn't imagine. It'd be very, very difficult for him. Yeah. I think he's... You know, his performances have made him kind of surplus to requirements, haven't they? I mean, it's difficult to... He's making up the numbers, basically.
Yeah, and they've made sourcing additions to the squad even more important.
Yeah, I mean, if he... I think that the first indicator that Arteta sort of saw him as someone capable of playing in a central role was the game at the Etihad when he played as kind of the false nine. And that experiment did not work. And I do wonder, you know, was that something Arteta intended on doing more often, or using him in the kind of role we played against Southampton more often? But there haven't been any great signs from him, apart from a very brief spell against Sheffield United, that he's got it in him. So, yeah, I mean, listen, it's a deal that's been pretty disastrous. And like you say, I don't really know how much more to say about it. I suppose the debate now is what Arsenal can do. You know, how do Arsenal get themselves out of this problem?
Which
again isn't straightforward.
No, it's absolutely not. We've made it really difficult for ourselves by giving him 200 grand a week, etc., for a period of 3 years. You know, so that really makes it complicated. And I suppose this is basically the worst case scenario in terms of this deal. You know, when we talked about it when it happened, we were hopeful that maybe the best case scenario is we get 12 to 18 months out of a player who had plenty of Premier League experience and was pretty decent for Chelsea, and then you deal with the decline, you know, in a year and a half. For it to be as precipitous as it has been so quickly means it's a huge, huge complication. And, you know, we've only got ourselves to blame, basically, for it. So, you know, there's no shame or harm. Well, shame or harm, you know, you can question, obviously, recruitment on many levels. But sometimes transfers don't work out for very many reasons. This one seems to be for very obvious reasons. But the bigger issue is if you keep doubling down, you know, and again, I kind of understand why he played him in this game, because he's desperately trying to get something out of a player who over the next, you know, few months we might need, basically, because of the amount of games we have to play and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, I can understand why he was, you know, he brought him on in a game maybe to try and give him a boost. You know, the West Brom game, for example, he brought him on. It was 3-0 or 4-0 when he brought him on, and was thinking, okay, you know, if he can get a goal, if he can get an assist, it might spark something into him. It didn't happen. He played him in this game looking for something that might spark him into life. Was he absolutely terrible? No. I think he's played worse for us this season than he did in this game against Southampton. But, you know, again, it didn't provide what we needed. And, you know, it's a problem they are definitely going to have to solve. So,
yeah, I'm trying to remember if there's an Arsenal player who's had such a bad start first 6 months or whatever it is, first half season with the club.
Not at 32.
Recovered it.
Not at 32. I don't remember any player of that age coming in and being this bad and recovering. I mean, I think you could maybe look at someone like Edu, for example, when he came to the club and he had this pretty disastrous start in terms of, you know, there was a whole passport issue. And then when he came in, I think he scored an own goal and then he got injured and he was in and out of the team. But he was a guy in his early to mid-20s. You know, mm-hmm. So there was time for him to recover and time for him, you know, and he wasn't coming from a club we all hate, you know. So, yeah, I don't recall a situation like this ever before, and how it's recoverable, I just don't know. I mean, he could play 10 out of 10. I'm not saying he will, and it would be hugely surprising, obviously, if he did anything like that. But he could play 10 out of 10 for the next 3 or 4 weeks, and the minute he has another game, which is disappointing, you know, he's back to square one. There comes a point of no return. I think we've kind of reached that with him. So, yeah. Look, this was the risk that they took when they brought him in. And this is what they're going to have to deal with. And it's down to Arteta and Edu to sort this one out, you know?
Is it remotely realistic to sort that in this transfer window?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with it. But I just don't think so. I think there's too much other stuff going on. I also think it would leave too much egg on face if they did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think in the summer, maybe, but it won't be easy.
No.
It won't be easy because when you commit to a good contract for somebody and offer them that security, finding someone who's going to take it, especially for someone who hasn't performed for a season.
Yeah, yeah. And look, it would be unfair to say that Willian was the only problem on the day. You know, there was a lot that didn't quite work out. Gabriel at the back, very rusty. Having been out for basically a month with COVID and, you know, having not played.
Yeah, he looked a long way off what he had looked like.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and one of the things that has been good in the last few weeks was the semblance of a partnership between Rob Holding and Pablo Marie, and Holding and Gabriel looked very the opposite of a partnership, if you like. And, you know, Holding wasn't great on the day either. I think Cedric at left back was not great. You know, I know I know we don't really have a natural option there.
It's difficult, yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult. But, you know, I saw, was it on the commentary, you know, after Cedric made about his third huge cross, which went out for a goal kick, and, you know, I can't remember who was on co-commentary, basically saying, well, you know, it's a bit difficult when you're playing on the left. And I'm thinking, it's not difficult when you're playing and you can cut in on your favourite foot and you can put a cross in. And Cedric, you know, one of the things he can do is deliver a ball well into the box. It just wasn't good whether he's playing on the left or the right. Midfield, Xhaka was like, well, yeah, he just was in one of those. He was absolutely serviceable, but you know, the partnership or lack of partnership with Elneny was obvious. Nicolas Pepe on the right-hand side, there's a discussion to be had there, I think, which I might save for the second half because I've got some questions about Nicolas Pepe. On the day, our most productive player in terms of what he did, creating, well, I don't know if he created five chances, but he had five key passes according to the stats. But then what the stats say and what my eyes told me were kind of different in some ways. Not to say that the key passes didn't happen, but there was so much other stuff going on with his game that didn't quite come off, you know, and a lot of it was stuff I really want him to be good at, but he makes look difficult.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, maybe it's a, like you say, we'll save it for the question, but there's definitely a conversation to be had around Pepe and whether his sort of grouping with Willian is fair in analysis. You know, I think people have divergent opinions on that. Mm. But I think, you know, I thought the central midfield partnership didn't work on the day. Xhaka and Elneny, surprise, surprise. I mean, we've seen that combination be problematic in the past. The absence of a true outlet at left back hurt us. We just basically weren't great on the day. And I can't say I was surprised. I mean, when I saw the lineup, there were a lot of underperforming players there, and you thought, well, you've got an opportunity here to step up and, you know, threaten Mikel Arteta's squad hierarchy.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to think of anybody who did that.
No. Nobody did. Nobody did. Yeah. You know, the
even Gabriel, you know, you'd probably have Marie and Louise ahead of him on this performance if you were doing it purely on that, you know? So
yeah,
it wasn't a good day at all.
No, it wasn't. I mean, Eddie and Nketiah got to go up front and, you know, again, I think there's a conversation there to be had about Eddie, and it's not to be hugely critical of him or anything like it. He did have a couple of chances. There was the Pepe pass, which, you know, he tried to toe poke, but he didn't make a good connection. It came off the defender, I think, which made it look a bit more dangerous, and Forster had to make a save. And there was one late on in injury time where it fell for him and he slashed it wide. And, you know, you can argue on one hand that a striker like Eddie needs service. He's a penalty box predator. That's who he is. You know, that's what he does. So if he doesn't get the service, can you properly judge his performance? But I would argue that you know, in the system in which we play, we need more from the centre forward than just being a six-yard guy or a guy who can play effectively between the penalty spot and the goal line. You know, you need more from your centre forward there. And I think we've seen quite a lot of Eddie, you know, and there's obviously quality there in terms of goal scoring. He's good in and around the box, but I just think his overall game is, you know, he can run and he can press, but I don't think he offers enough generally as a centre forward, as a nine in this system, to merit a great deal more in terms of starting. You know, I think there comes a point where you see a player and you can kind of identify what he is, what he's good at, where he is going to be effective. And then when you play him in a role which isn't getting the best out of him, you have to say, well, is it fair on player, and is it the right thing for the club to keep persisting?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely thought, looking at the subs bench, you know, we got Partey and Saka on 58 minutes. Lacazette, we had to wait until 72, and I was kind of itching for Lacazette to be on earlier, which I think tells you what Nketiah's sort of all-round contribution was like. Mm. He is, like you say, a penalty box player. And I think operating with that sort of striker is very difficult. There are only certain circumstances in which it really works. I think one is that you play in a front two and, you know, their sort of responsibilities are slightly less. I think another way is if you're just an exceptionally good team who's creating a ton of chances, then having a guy who has great movement in the 18-yard box, you know, that can be beneficial, but we're not that team.
Yeah.
And I think at this point in our development, we do need more from our centre forward than that. If I imagine, like, what the good projection of Eddie Nketiah looks like, it's probably someone like Javier Hernandez at United, like a guy who you bring on in the last 15 minutes when you're chasing a goal and you've got 70% possession and he's like a extra man in the penalty box, he can sniff something out, you know. But I don't see an eventuality where he's a starting player at Arsenal. I certainly don't foresee that.
No, I don't. And that's why then you have to start thinking about your squad. And we talked about this, I think, on the last episode, where you're looking at the striking situation at Arsenal with Eddie, who's got coming up on 12 months left of his contract.
Yeah.
You know, are you making a decision? Are you giving him a new one? Why are you giving him a new one if you are? Is it just to protect his value, or do you see him as somebody who can start? I don't think he's shown enough to demonstrate that he should be a regular starter. Maybe a third choice striker, I don't know. But look, Lacazette is into the final 12 months of his deal as well come the summer. There are no efforts being made to give him a new deal. There is an issue, I suppose, with Aubameyang in terms of his age. He's going to be, what, 32 in the summer? And then you're looking at this sort of gap in terms of what are we doing? And I know people are screaming right now. They're screaming the name Balogun, and I get it. I completely get it. But it is a complicated situation in the sense that do you give the minutes or do you develop a player who isn't going to play for you? If he's not going to sign a new deal, do you take the short-term benefit, perhaps, of having a striker like Balogun in the team for games like this? Mm. You know, and okay, maybe he leaves, but you have, you know, some benefit from the player being on the pitch. It helps you win games or score goals in the very short term. But if you're Balogun and you're looking at the situation at Arsenal right now and you don't see and you're not confident enough in your own ability to see that there's a real pathway here for you if you put pen to paper, you know, it is tricky. And of course, the agent thing is a tricky element to this as well, in that Balogun and Nketiah have the same agent. So, you know, how can you tell one player one thing and another player another thing? Or can you be brutal about one player without pissing off the agent? You know, it is one of those quite difficult situations to deal with.
I can imagine a situation where sort of, you know, Balogun and Nketiah have both got meetings lined up with Arteta and Edu on the same day, and like the agent comes in with one and they tell him, yeah, you're our number one striking prospect for the future, and then they leave and they come with the next one and they just tell him exactly the same thing. I mean, it is awkward to manage. Arteta is so emphatic in his praise of Eddie Nketiah. It's been the case since Arteta arrived. As soon as Nketiah came back from Leeds, he was really, really positive about him. And of course, he kept him, you know, didn't send him back out on loan, which was a big call at the time. And I wonder about that. I've been thinking, like, is it because he sees something in Nketiah that, you know, maybe we don't necessarily see? Mm. And then now I currently think, is it just because he realises that actually, having an Eddie Nketiah in your squad, a guy who's very clearly third choice, but probably not desperately unhappy about being third choice behind Aubameyang and Lacazette, who hasn't cost the club anything, really, is pretty handy. And it won't last forever because eventually he'll want to play, or eventually someone else comes through, maybe it's Balogun, and he moves on. But maybe that is just sort of a useful slot in the squad to be able to fill with an academy player, you know?
I think that's probably right. Because if you look at how much playing time Nketiah has had, you know, there was a small or short period, wasn't there, where he was starting games in the Premier League when Lacazette was going through a really bad run of form. But most part, he doesn't start in the Premier League. He's starting in the Europa League. He's starting in, you know, maybe a couple of the cup games, but he's not starting in the Premier League week in, week out. He's not getting tons and tons of Premier League minutes, and I think that probably tells you more about, you know, the situation than anything Arteta says, being positive or talking up the qualities or the potential of a player. Maybe isn't any bad thing either if you are perhaps minded in the future to you know, to move them on.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think maybe that's part of it too. I think it's also just about keeping a player happy who isn't getting very many minutes. I mean, Nketiah is basically someone who, what we're saying is, you don't ever really want to have to start. But if you've got 7 subs or 9 subs, you wouldn't mind having him amongst there if you needed a goal in the last 15 minutes. But the Balogun thing is what makes this whole situation interesting. I have to say, like, purely from a supporter's perspective, I am a bit uncomfortable about the Balogun thing. I do think that sort of, you know, he did that thing of like, well, I say he, whoever manages his social media account very cannily put out a sort of compilation of his recent goals as soon as Arsenal went out of the cup against Southampton.
What do you think about that?
Well, if it was Mesut Ozil, I would heavily criticise him for it. So I think I have to toe the same line.
Do you think it was the player or his people?
I couldn't say. I would assume, I mean, unless the player's video editing skills are pretty good for a footballer.
Didn't he just take, like, Arsenal videos and, you know, you can put stuff together on your phone. These are young, technologically savvy young people.
That's true. He's 15 years younger than me. But, I mean, I don't know. Either way, I feel a bit weird about that. I sort of feel like, listen, maybe he's not getting offered the deal he wants, right? But do we think he's getting offered a bad deal?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know the specifics. But do we think, for a guy who's never played a Premier League minute, he's being offered a deal that should make him go, this is like a, you know, I refuse to sign this? I can't imagine that. Maybe. If he's so confident and believes in himself, sign the deal. You'll play.
Sure, but maybe it's about what's on offer from elsewhere. And, you know, I don't want to put this entirely on the player because, you know, I think he said more than once that he wants to stay, or certainly Arteta has said that the player wants to stay. And I think the implication was that the uncertainty or the difficulty has come from the agent. And look, you can say that's an agent doing the best that he can for his client, making sure he gets the best deal possible. If he's got assurances of first team football and good wages on offer from abroad because he's available for free, then those have got to be very exciting and very interesting opportunities for him. If he's got an offer from Arsenal to play second fiddle or third fiddle to Aubameyang and Lacazette for another 18 months, you know, what's the thing you want to do when you're 19? It's play football. Mm-hmm. And look, yeah, I can see both sides of this one. You know, you might say that, you know, a guy who hasn't really proved himself in any way to post that kind of a video, it's a bit much. You know, you shouldn't do that.
That's what I think.
You know, on the other hand, it might just be like the ruthless killer mentality that we need from a player who's going to come into a team and say, well, fuck all of you guys, I'm going to score goals if you give me a chance. You know, and that's, of course, being wildly optimistic about it. So
if you want to stay at Arsenal and you believe in yourself enough, sign the deal. Prove it.
Mm.
That's how I feel. And I know that that's not how Edu or Arteta should see it. But speaking as a fan, I just feel like, why should we commit to a guy who's not committed to us?
Sure. I mean, I get that. I see that point of view as well.
And also, everything he's done so far, Eddie Nketiah did it at the same age. Like, he scored some goals in the 23s. Great. He came on and scored in the first team. Great. Eddie Nketiah did that too. Sign the deal. Commit. Play.
Mm.
Show us that you're better.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it. And I slightly worry that we're sort of putting him up on a pedestal and he's like a kid who's sort of frankly done nothing.
Yeah, no, I absolutely see that. But I also see the side of this where you say, okay, we've seen what Eddie can give us and it's okay. And in circumstances, it can be better than that. But generally speaking, we need a bit more. And Balogun is a player who could potentially, I'm not saying definitely, can give you more because he's a different kind of a striker. You know, he's got, I think, a bit more all-roundness to his game, if you like. Mm. Whether he can make that step up at senior level, that's another question, because there have been plenty of good young strikers at Arsenal who have simply failed to make the grade when they've stepped up to senior football, not necessarily at Arsenal, and not failed to make the grade, that's unfair, but haven't perhaps been the player that people hoped they would be when they've been given a chance at senior level, right? There's loads of them who've down the years been really, really, really good at under 23 or youth level or reserve level and whatever you want to call it. And then they go and play first team football somewhere and it's kind of okay. They've done fine. Think of all the names. Akpom, Jay Simpson, Chuba Akpom. I said Chuba Akpom, Afobe, Lupoli, Bentner even to an extent, but obviously he'd have much bigger first team impact. There was Amici. There were, you know, there've been loads who've just not done it. So, but I can see the argument where people say, look, we know what we've got with Eddie. Why not give Balogun the opportunity? But again, it comes back to giving time to a player who isn't going to commit to the club. And I understand that perspective as well. So it is a really, there's no simple answer to this one.
No, there isn't. And it is kind of a standoff at this point, isn't it? It's stalemate because the club will say, why should we play? You haven't signed the deal. And he'll say, why should I sign the deal? I haven't played. So
catch 22.
It is. And I said before, I don't think this ends with the player staying at Arsenal, and I still don't think that. I mean, maybe I'll be proved wrong, and this is all, you know, brilliant brinkmanship, but when a manager sort of openly criticises an agent, it doesn't make me feel like they're about to do a deal together.
No, and also, I'm not, you know, whatever, if you want to look at the video thing in the most positive light, by all means, I just wonder how things like that go down internally as well. Probably not.
Well, not good.
Great.
If we can extrapolate from sort of Mesut Ozil, you know, things that are kind of counter messaging public.
We've just lost. Well, and you're, you know, look, there's a time and a place, et cetera, et cetera. Can we come back to the game very quickly before we end part one?
Sorry.
You know, when you look at the performance, you know, statistically, I think both teams had 11 shots. Both teams had 2 shots on target. You know, we were under par. The team didn't play well. There were too many individual performances that weren't good, which meant that the collective performance wasn't good. But it took a kind of freaky own goal. I think Leno had that cross shot under control until Gabriel stuck his foot out and it went in. So it was a very fine margin that cost us the game, which isn't to make any excuses about it, but that's what it was when you look at it. The one issue where I think the one thing that really frustrated me about this game was moving Saka to left back.
Right.
I'm curious what you thought of that, because, you know, this is a guy who gives us, I think, more than most people in the final third. And we brought him on and then we moved him to left back. Yeah, it just, you know, you're moving him away from the area of the pitch in which he can do the most damage and cause the most problems. And I think even late on, there was a really good cross.
Where he got forward
towards Lacazette. And I think another thing that frustrated me about this game was, you know, Lacazette did his best to get there, but there was nobody gambling at the back post. Nobody was there to try and get on the end of that cross. So, you know, I know he was able to produce a little bit, but did it not diminish or take away from his effectiveness by moving him, you know, into a nominally a defensive position to start with?
Yeah, I don't mind as much, because I feel like in that period of the game, we were really on top and he was kind of more at liberty to get forward. So it didn't bother me particularly, because I just feel like the way we play, overlapping fullbacks who can cross the ball are pretty integral. And in the absence of Tierney, we just had no way of doing that on the left flank. So it felt like we weren't achieving any kind of penetration. I mean, listen, in my ideal world, we'd have 11 Sakas, you know, and he could play every position, because I genuinely think he excels in most of them. But I did think we improved, you know, in that last period. And there was a point where I thought we are going to score here, actually, just when we were beginning to exert a little bit of pressure.
We did have a good spell in terms of territory and possession, you know, whether that was game state or whether that was some of the changes that we made. And certainly the introduction of Thomas Partey made a difference into midfield,
that
because,
made a big difference.
You know, he's good at playing in midfield. And I don't
evidence continues to suggest that he is good at playing in midfield. Yeah.
There's some fucking cracking insight there from both of us. But you know what I mean? he does lift the level of the team significantly when he comes on. So,
yeah, we finished the match with 62% possession. I mean, that's that unusual when a team has the lead for a long period. I just kind of came away from it. I mean, there weren't many great chances, were there?
No.
I can't think of many sort of pronounced misses. You mentioned the Nketiah ones. That Lacazette one where he almost got on the end of that Saka cross very, very late on.
Yeah.
That did stick in the memory slightly. I don't know if it was just sort of the recency of it being towards the end of the game. But no, I mean, Southampton did pose the occasional threat on the break as well. They had a claim for a penalty, didn't they, at one point?
We did as well. I mean, the penalty that Southampton claimed, there was a handball, but it was very, very ball to hand. It was the kind of
the
kind of ball to hand that was a penalty 3 months ago.
yeah.
But
I do think that's weird, actually. Like, changing the application of laws during a season has quite a dramatic effect, actually.
Yeah.
I find it odd that you can sort of do that.
So, look. There you go. We're out of the cup. And, you know,
how do you feel it affects the Premier League game on Tuesday night? Do you think it has any impact at all? This was pretty much their best team.
Well, I think there was maybe an element of rope-a-dope there from Hasenhüttl in that I suspect Arteta was thinking, you know, that he would be thinking along the same lines, that the Premier League game is probably the one in which you're going to put out your strongest team. you know?
Yeah.
And Hasenhüttl basically put out Southampton's strongest team in this game. And I suspect he'll put out a very similar team tomorrow night. So whether it has an impact on them physically, we'll wait and see. From an Arsenal perspective, you know, you're looking to welcome back into the team or to the starting 11. I think Luiz will come back in. I think Tierney obviously will come back in. Saka will come in. Smith Rowe will come in. So you've got fresh legs in important positions. Partey, I can't remember if I mentioned him there, but obviously he's going to start. So you've got fresh legs coming back into important positions. Maybe Aubameyang, yeah, we don't know. Obviously, you know, that I think might have had an impact as well, whether Aubameyang was scheduled to start that game or not, we don't know.
Yeah, you know? It's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah. Because Martinelli didn't... he played about an hour, didn't he?
Yeah,
so,
didn't really work for him. But then, you know, that's true of most of what happened to our front three. So,
yeah, I do wonder if Aubameyang might have started. Who knows how much difference that would have made.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'll be interesting on Tuesday. I mean, it'll be a kind of psychological advantage to Southampton, if nothing else. It's a six-pointer, really, in the battle for 10th.
Yeah, look, I think it's put a little bit more pressure on us because we've lost. Losing was perhaps a consequence of the team that we picked and the lack of performance. So people need to see a response. You can perhaps, I'm not going to say justify, but it becomes easier to justify the team selection for the FA Cup game if you then go and win the league game.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, of course. If he wins the league game, so I kind of think people will compartmentalise accordingly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, interesting to see. I mean, like you say, it'll be quite a different team. It was seven changes for the Cup, and I expect we'll see seven more.
All right. Well, look, we will leave it there for part one. We're going to come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to part two of the Arscast Extra. This is part two. Yes, obviously. This is part
two. It was part one, and now it's part two. We've done it in the usual order this week.
That's good. Sequential is good. Anyway, this is the part of the show.
We should put out part three. We always just keep it for ourselves, but maybe we should add part three to the recording this
week. Let's do it. Let's take a break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part three of the show where we're actually going to answer the questions that you sent to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog, ArsBlog, I'm not Australian, ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon, from which, James, comes the question about Nicolas Pepe. And it comes from Charlie Birchall. And Charlie says, I think Pepe is being unfairly judged at the moment and would offer these discussion points for context. He has never played in a functioning Arsenal team with a number 10. Even Saka playing on the right without Emile Smith Rowe looked lost earlier this season, and everyone said he shouldn't play out there. He's also had zero managerial support. We've all been somewhere where we've had difficulty with the manager, and it's awful. Arteta has thrown him under the bus publicly and continued to start Willian over him despite a great FA Cup final and his awful early season form. I think he means Willian there and not Pepe. I think this is worth discussing, as I think he would be a lot better playing in the Arsenal first team with Emile Smith Rowe at the moment, and it's just unfortunate that Saka is in great form on that right-hand side.
Yeah, well, it's a tricky one for me. I don't think Pepe has been as bad as Willian.
I agree.
But even at the highest estimate of what Willian has cost us, Pepe will have cost us about three times as much. So I know people say don't attach his price tag to it, but how can you possibly not? How can you possibly not regard his signing as... and the fee that we paid for him as important in assessing his contribution. I just think it's inextricable. It really is.
Yeah, it is difficult, isn't it? You know, you see, here's the thing with him. I thought against Southampton that there were obviously parts of his game which were effective. A couple of through balls. There was that free kick for Martinelli. And, you know, the ball to Nketiah and the back heel to Nketiah and, you know, the five key passes that he made. But then there are other moments where I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, okay, you really have to do better there because this is bread and butter stuff. There was one where Bellerin played him down the right-hand side where he's got space in front of him. And you're thinking, this is where we want Nicolas Pepe to be. This is the kind of situation we should be working to put Pepe in, you know? And... Yeah. His touch was poor and the defender got back and cleared the ball and the danger was gone. There was another one where, you know, he showed for the ball. You see, here's the thing with Pepe. I don't think there's a, you know, any kind of lack of effort or application, even if I think there are parts of his game in terms of supporting the players around him he could do better, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that's more to do with a lack of either awareness or whatever it might be. But I don't think there's a lack of effort in his game. I think he tries and he wants to do well. But there was a ball played into him by Bellerin. He came, he showed for it, received it with his back to goal, and it just bounced off him. And it just bounced away from him. And it was bread and butter, basic stuff that he needs to be able to do an awful lot better. Because what happens is play breaks down. We can't combine. We cannot build attacks when the ball is bouncing off an attacker like that, you know?
I agree. And by the way, apologies for the puppy training that's going on.
I can hear it there.
Yeah. But I think that a thing happens with Pepe where we see him do something amazing. And for some reason, as a group of supporters, we extrapolate that therefore he's capable of doing that consistently. And I think, how can I put it? Technique is great, but it is a very small part of what makes a successful footballer and a very, very successful footballer. And I just think he's lacking in too many of the other component areas. Like, you know, he might be the most skillful player in training. He might be the guy who can score a goal no one else can score. But I just think that's a small part of the equation of what makes someone elite. And I think that we kind of view him like a YouTube player sometimes. We kind of view him like as a highlight reel and we go, but he did this and he did that. And it's like, yeah, he did, but not with any consistency.
That's that's the thing for me. It's the consistency of what he can and can't produce. Because, you know, in his first season, you can decide yourselves out there whether these are reasons or excuses where, you know, things didn't quite work for him. And you're saying, well, look, it's a new league. He arrived late, you know, didn't get a full preseason. Then there was the whole Emery business where things started going wrong and you know, you know, a new language, a new country, new teammates, all of those things where you see, you can maybe put it down to adaptation. I think it's not unreasonable to say that it's adaptation. When you're 18 months in and those issues are still in his game and you can't really point to those things as being reasons / excuses, then you have to ask, you know, is that the player? And I would just take issue with one small thing in the question, in that Arteta threw him under the bus publicly over the red card, right? And that was a mistake. And, you know, people who were critical of that had every right to be critical of that. But you can't be critical of that and then also critical of Arteta backing his players when they don't play well, as he did after this game with Pepe and Willian, saying, we're going to support them publicly. You know, we're going to support them as much as we can. Of course, he's going to say that in public. You know, part of the reason Lampard got canned is because he didn't offer his players that protection. I think, you know, Arteta got that one wrong. And has he learned from it? Probably he's not going to do that again with other players. But I think in general, his messaging about Pepe has been pretty consistent in terms of, you know, Pepe, the player, they want to get more from him. They want to support him. They want to give him the opportunities, all of those things. But it hasn't really happened. And I think, you know, maybe a consequence of the Willian signing is that Pepe felt devalued or demotivated or you know, diminished in some way. And, you know, that's not unreasonable from his perspective either. But, you know, what we're seeing from Pepe now is what we've seen from Pepe in every step of his Arsenal career.
And yeah, pretty that, much. With the exception of a little lift. Yeah. I do think towards the end of last season there was a little lift. But not well. And he had an outstanding performance in the FA Cup.
Yeah.
He was really excellent in a team full of excellent performances. But I do just think consistency, and I know, you know, Arteta has he was incredibly critical of him after that Leeds game, probably unfairly so. He has also spoken quite positively about Pepe and about his talent. I suppose actions speak louder than words in terms of selecting him, and I do think he contributes a lot more than Willian. But I do think that it is worth sorry to bring it back to the numbers, but like, the highest estimate of what Willian is making that I've heard is 200 grand, right? A week. So that's about 10 million quid a year, which is about £30 million over the course of a three-year contract.
Yeah.
Pepe's transfer fee plus his wages is already, in terms of what it's cost Arsenal, north of 100 million, you know to say. So even if we can sell Pepe for 30 million, we'll have lost twice on him what we've lost on Willian. So the numbers do matter, and then, you know, the Pepe signing is a complete economic catastrophe. And when you look at our squad construction, the amount of resource that was diverted into that one signing was wildly irresponsible. And I know that anyway, that's not his fault, but I can't separate it. I know people are like, you must separate it. I can't help it. I can't help but look at it in its context. For the player, yeah, he's okay. Like, you know, he's doing all right. He can be useful. I'm sure of it. He's definitely more useful than Willian, and sort of saying their names in the same breath as if they're the same player is unfair. Is he close to what Saka offers? Not in my mind.
Not at the moment, no. But, I mean, there maybe is a point there where he hasn't played a great deal with someone like Smith Rowe. And, like, how do you do it, though? I mean, how do you take Saka out of that position when he's gone in there and played as well as he does? And
difficult.
You know, if you do and Pepe doesn't play well, people will say, well, what the fuck were you doing? That works. So,
I mean, Saka's playing as well as a right-sided attacker now as he has in any other position.
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing his best performances, I think,
for sure,
in that role, which, you know, makes it really difficult to upset that balance. Listen, I do have sympathy for Pepe because there are some mitigating factors around changes in manager, changes in system, like you say, not playing with a number 10 consistently. And maybe he'll get that run. Maybe he will. But at the moment, I just don't have faith that he can seize that opportunity. And it's not to do with ability. It's not to do with his ability to dribble past a guy or smash it in the top corner, you know, one time out of 12 or whatever it is. I don't doubt it. But there are other aspects that I just feel he doesn't deliver on.
Like the late free kick.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, I mean, it's such a missed opportunity. I'm not saying that he should be criticized for not smashing it into the top corner from that position, but I think it's right to be frustrated when he smashes it over the bar from that position with all the Arsenal players who are in the box. You know, there's a line between being ambitious and being sensible with a free kick, you know, from that position where you could deliver a good strong ball into a dangerous area where it takes a nick off someone or someone gets a head on it or just flicks it on, you know, to put it over the bar is really frustrating. Really frustrating. Yeah. So it just kind of was an encapsulation of what drives people a bit mad about him. But look, it is what it is.
I do think as well, like, he's a fascinating character. Like, he's a really interesting character because a lot of what he does on the ball shows incredible self-confidence and bravery, really, in terms of like what he's prepared to take on. But there's also something about his personality that means I don't feel like that transmits in a very obvious way. He certainly doesn't feel like how can I put it? I suppose he I never think he carries himself like a star.
I think that's fair. I mean, that could be, you know, I'm not saying it's unfair, but, you know, you can't expect somebody to be what they're not. But I know what you mean in terms of the attitude he takes onto the pitch.
Yeah, like it's slightly contradictory, and I'm admitting that because I do think there is a real kind of obviously a bit of showmanship and courage and in the way that he plays. But equally, I sometimes feel like there's not enough swagger. There's not enough sense of it being his game, his team. And maybe he just doesn't feel that way. But I also kind of think, is that just sort of who he is?
Yeah.
It's a really interesting one. I'm not sure.
Is it, just very finally on this one quickly, is it something we should be concerned about that since his arrival, Emery has had concerns, reservations about him? Freddie Ljungberg had concerns and reservations about him, and it's very clear that Mikel Arteta has had concerns and reservations about him. Is, you know, does that tell us something?
I think it has to. I mean, you know, unless you just think, I basically think if three coaches tell you something, and I think this applies to Mesut Ozil to an extent as well, you know, the chances are they have divergent enough personalities that, you know, there's something to be read into the fact that they all arrive at similar conclusions, and they will know their own mind sufficiently for that to mean something. I do sympathise with Pepe, but I also wonder how much we're prepared to move the goalposts to sort of say that he's doing well. Like, I just think the expectations have been lowered so dramatically that I can't sort of divorce myself from what the expectations were when he arrived.
Yeah, I think probably in time, and maybe not at the moment, I think there's reason to look at why that deal happened when clearly the head coach at the time wanted something different, completely different, and when that level of output, that money could have been used for something that could have benefited the team much more greatly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think Arsenal will reflect on it. And I would be extremely surprised if anyone at Arsenal was given authority to go into the market with that kind of transfer fee attached anytime soon. I mean, without, setting aside the current economic situation.
But without it, like a fucking dossier as to why this is the best possible way we could spend this money.
Sure.
Whereas I think why we spend
even
that
then,
money.
I think there'll be reticence. I mean, they spend big money on Partey, but it's still a way off.
Yeah, but you can see why, to an extent, that was so important. I just think there are real questions as to why we spent that money on that player that go beyond him. I'm not saying it's his fault.
Mm.
So
yeah, absolutely. Anyway. Let's have a question about... Okay, it's pronunciation time.
See, the Ødegaard.
Ødegaard?
Yeah, the D is silent. Here's the thing. Like, we're going to have to just get over this one a little bit because we have this weird...
He's not going to be called that in England, is he?
No, he's not. And we have this weird sort of strange situation with pronunciations where it's Ceballos, but it's not Ceballos, and it's Bellerin and not Bellerin, and all these kind of things that we have to contend with. So pronunciation wars, let's try not to, I think...
Okay, I'm going to say...
I don't think we're going to offend anyone if we call him Ødegaard, are we?
Ødegaard. Okay, let's go with that.
Please don't kill us, Norwegians.
By the way, I enjoyed this question from East Lower on Twitter, who says, is Ødegaard going to be as good as his namesake, Remigard? Which I liked. But it relies on some mispronunciation.
Of course.
Sammy on Twitter says, we need one non-homegrown spot for Ødegaard. Squad list of which includes 17 non-homegrown players will be submitted. If Renarsson isn't the one who's not leaving, who is leaving, I think he must mean, which player should Arsenal not register? And he suggests Mustafi or Willian. It's an interesting one, isn't it? They do need someone to go.
Well, I mean, Runarsson is the obvious one. So if Runarsson goes, if they can get him on loan somewhere, which I think they will be pushing heaven and earth to do, because they can have... Well, I mean, I just mean from not really reflective of him as a player. We've had that discussion and there's a reason why we brought in Matt Ryan. So I just think in terms of registering a new player, he is the most obvious one. He really is. So, you know, what they will be offering to other clubs around Europe, I mean, how many clubs around Europe are going to want Runarsson? That's another question. It's a difficult one because, you know, he obviously hasn't had a good time at Dijon. He hasn't had a good time at Arsenal. So in terms of his stock, it's not particularly great. So he would be the obvious one. I think the one for me is Mustafi.
Yeah, that's, I think, the one that's going to be the decision, isn't it? You know, what do they...
Yeah, he hasn't been in the squad for weeks and weeks and weeks anyway. I know he provides a little bit of assurance at centre-half, but we do have Callum Chambers there as well. Yeah. So, you know, if you're looking for a body, there's a body.
I guess that's the guy who wouldn't make the cut. Yeah, it does feel like it may go that way because, you know, Arsenal as well might, you know, maybe this won't be the end of their business. Maybe they'll still be looking to do a left back from what Mikel Arteta said, which means they've got to potentially find another spot. So, yeah, there's still work to be done on that front. But, yeah, I think Renarsson or Mustafi is going to be one of those guys, isn't it? Okay. How do you feel about Matt Ryan, by the way?
I saw you... You did a piece about this, you know, in terms of his saves and what have you. I think what he is, with the greatest of respect to Matt Ryan, I kind of hope he doesn't play.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, every game is important now. It's Premier League games. Leno is playing in Premier League games.
I mean, I don't think he'd be picked over Leno. I can't see what fixtures are coming up.
There isn't one. And Europa League, you know, Leno's going to play in that. You're not playing your second best goalkeeper in games against Benfica. And as you know, hopefully, if we make some progress as we head towards like quarterfinals, semifinals, if we get that far in the Europa League, you're not playing your second choice goalkeeper. So what Matt Ryan is a little bit of a safety blanket. Given his experience with Brighton, I think he was decent enough for Brighton until he wasn't, if you like. You know, it's obviously nice that he's an Arsenal fan as well. He used to get up at all times in the morning, as, you know, many of our listeners down in that part of the world do, the huge commitment to getting up to watching your team. You know, so that's a really nice aspect to this story. And if he's called upon, you know, because of injury or whatever it might be, then I think there's just a little bit more reassurance there than if we only had Runarsson. So
yeah, I've got no issues with it either. Yeah. I think it's like, you know, it's funny. Sometimes you get emergency dispensation to sign a goalkeeper if you have a load of injuries. And it felt like this was kind of an emergency situation for Arsenal. They just needed to bring in somebody who provided some experience backup.
You know? Exactly. And to be fair, a lot of our Australian listeners have been talking about this for weeks and weeks, going, come on, like Matt Ryan, he's not playing for Brighton. We should do it. We should do it. And look, there you go. So those guys are going to be really happy. If he can make a contribution, great. But I just feel, like I said to you, I think last week when we were talking about which is the one position that you would like to fill, you know, goalkeeper was the one I was most anxious about in terms of not having any sufficient cover for Bernd Leno. But with the best will in the world and everything else, I hope Leno stays fit and plays every game between now and the end of the season, because he's our best goalkeeper. Simple as that. So
he is, yeah. And I thought he was. I thought he was pretty good the other day.
I have a question here, just on the Ødegaard thing as well.
Oh, yeah.
If I can bring it in. Okay, hang on a second. There's one about shirt numbers, but I'm not sure that's the right one. Rupert Day, who's at Rupert Day, says, with Ødegaard, do you feel Arteta will look to start him and Emile Smith-Rowe together regularly? If so, in what structure would that be, or are they purely rotation options? And then Henrik Ho Jakobsen, who's at Henrik Hoes on Twitter, or Henke Hoes on Twitter, rather, says, hi, guys, how are you? All good, thank you. Is the loan deal with Ødegaard maybe too short-sighted, since there's no option to buy in the summer in it? So those two things. How do you see him being used, and, you know, the option to buy? Is that an issue?
I think they can play together, because they've both played multiple positions. I mean, Smith-Rowe, listen, his favourite area is central area, but he's played a lot of his football wide, particularly for England at youth level. He's played wide from the right, wide from the left. He did a bit of that with the Arsenal first team, I seem to recall, when he first came in under Unai Emery, playing from wide right. So I think he can do that. I think Odegaard's played on the right as well. It's funny, you know, we were talking about why, you know, Buendia might not be a good option because he's played from the right-hand side, but Ødegaard has too. I do think this is a great signing, actually. Like, I know, I understand the reservations about it being a loan and not permanent, but given the restrictions Arsenal are working under, given the financial situation, given the fact that it's January, to find a player of this caliber available in this month, I think is a real coup.
Yep. I agree. I mean, there's a hugely talented player there, and for him to be available and to come to Arsenal is fantastic. If people want to know a bit more about him, what kind of player he is, we did a thing on the Patreon with Alex Kirkland from the Spanish Football Podcast. We talked a bit about his development at Real Madrid, why they're letting him go now in January, having you know, having brought him back. He was supposed to be on loan for 2 years at Real Sociedad, and they brought him back. So why is he available now? I talk about that with Alex, so it's over on the Patreon if you're a member. If not, you can sign up to listen to that one. What I do think, though, is we're going to have to be just a little bit patient, because, you know, the last time he played 90 minutes of domestic football was June of last year. He's only played 9 games this season for Real Madrid. So they're going to have to find the right balance between getting this guy up to speed for Premier League and hopefully the business end of the Europa League, and, you know, making sure that he doesn't break down, or doesn't pick up an injury in the same way that Denis Suarez did, for example. So, you know, he's not going to come in. People shouldn't be expecting him to come in straight away and play 90 minutes, or anything like that. There's going to have to be a period where we ease him into action. And that's something people are going to have to get into their heads, I think, because it's just not realistic when you've played so little to come in and be playing week in, week out every game. But I agree with you. The talent and, you know, what's out there on the market for us to bring in this guy on loan, I think is a really great move, which isn't to say it's going to be a brilliant signing. Nobody can make that prediction. But if he can get fit and if he can play regularly, you know, he's a really good player. And it's exciting. It's an exciting signing.
How do you feel about the kind of loan aspect of it and not having the permanent option?
I look, we've said this countless times. We've said it countless times that we should not go and spend a load of money in January unless it's on the right player. Or if the right player is not available to us, we have to find a different solution. This might be that different solution. So I've got no problem with the loan. The idea that there is no option to buy at the end of it doesn't bother me one bit either. Don't care. You know, it doesn't mean we can't make a bid. It doesn't mean that if it goes well for him here and if he likes it at Arsenal and we like him, that, you know, we're precluded from making a bid. You know, of course we can. If we want to buy him, we can make an offer to Real Madrid. So, you know, I think Absolutely, Madrid have yeah. sort of hedged their bets a little bit there, you know, because maybe it's not clear if Zidane is going to be there next season or not. They're leaving it open for a new coach who might want Ødegaard who might not. So they're not going to commit to anything at this point. But the idea that you know, if it's really impressive, we're somehow precluded from making a bid is just wrong. So, no, I don't see any issue. And I also think discussions like that can often delay a deal or they can slow things down. So if you're not dealing with that, you get the player in quicker, you get him fit quicker, you get him onto the pitch quicker, and it's a better outcome for the club.
Yeah, I agree. I just think to be able to sort a signing like this, you know, relatively swiftly is great. And listen, I don't know if he'll play. He certainly won't play straight away, and I don't know how regularly he'll play after that. I mean, he will have come because he wants to play minutes, but I think, you know, there'll be a lot of rotation between him and Smith Rowe. But I'm excited to see him. I mean, you know, this is a guy who's incredibly well thought of. Madrid, certainly in the summer, saw him as part of their big rebuild and rejuvenation of the squad. It hasn't quite panned out that way. But yeah, like I said, I think it's a coup. And I look forward to seeing him before long. Hopefully that deal, well, hopefully by the time you're listening to this even, that might be done.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. He is in London, isn't he? He's having his medical today and what have you. So,
Exciting times. So, what about this question? FPL. Actually, no, I don't want to do that one. Sorry. I'm not even going to finish the name because it will upset you too much that I haven't done it.
all the FPL accounts now going.
All the FPL accounts
are
raging.
Was it me?
Rambo on the Discord asks, after his departure, what is your favourite Mesut Ozil memory? And I think you had a question as well, didn't you, about Ozil?
We did. Favourite Mesut Ozil memory? I mean, it's impossible to look beyond some of the assists. I know the goal against Ludogorets was just phenomenal. And I think that's the one that everyone will pick if they're asked to, you know, choose a Mesut Ozil moment. Which I should say, the caliber of the opposition takes nothing away from that goal for me because it was just unbelievable. I think the one that kind of sums up his time for me is that first time assist for Olivier Giroud, where he kind of flicks it on in the center circle. Giroud takes the ball on and almost doesn't score, which kind of sums up Giroud as well in a way. But I think just in terms of moments on a pitch where you see the full scope of a player's vision and technical ability, I think that's the one I would pick.
The one I would go for, and again, a lot of people say Ludogorets, and I understand why, it's a beautiful, beautiful goal, would actually be, you remember when we went to New York and Arsenal played Chelsea, and famously my flight was delayed and I missed the first two goals. Arsenal scored a brace of early goals, but I arrived just in time, I believe, to see Mesut Ozil score short 5 minutes before half time. And it was a brilliant counter-attacking goal with Alexis Sanchez. It's one of those where he sort of volleys it into the ground.
Goes
over the keeper.
I remember that, yeah.
And I have very fond memories of that goal and that time. And I suppose the sort of, you know, the old chop into the ground became a kind of quintessential Ozil thing. So, yeah, I think that would be My favourite was Erling Braut.
Okay, fair enough. The question that I had was also from the Discord. It comes from Seb3000, who says, "Morning, chaps. What lessons should Arsenal learn from the Mesut Ozil situation to improve in the future?"
Well, I think there are lessons to be learned about the kind of contract that they gave Mesut Ozil, at the age they gave it to him. I think there were even kind of, you know, statistical things that suggested that maybe his underlying figures weren't as good at that point and maybe they shouldn't have pursued it. I think as well, Arsenal allowed themselves to get into a very treacherous position where they stood to lose a player for free who had cost them an awful lot of money and was incredibly valuable on the open market. And not just one, two, of course, with Alexis Sanchez as well. I think that's the main lesson, isn't it? To not let players get to that point where they have so much control that your choice is either to lose them for nothing or pay them a hugely inflated amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, I think the lesson is that don't be afraid. Look, manage those situations better. Obviously, don't let yourself get into a situation where a guy's got 12 months left on his deal or you know, you're over a barrel in terms of negotiating. I think that's the key lesson. And, you know, whatever you want to say about Sanyehi, and I don't really have very much good to say about him at all, at least he acknowledged that that was a problem for Arsenal, and that's not something that we would do even if he then went and didn't do anything about it, you know, but there was an acknowledgement at least that that was a thing. But also maybe don't be afraid to let talent go, because in doing
at
so
at a decent price, at a premium, as at a decent he probably would have fetched at one point,
or you know, or at an age where you think, you know, the perception of a player leaving to the club is perhaps a bit more harmful than it actually is. Like, you know, when you look back on it, and again, I'm not trying to be critical of anyone in particular here, but like when you look back on it, and I, you know, I'll hold my hands up at the time, and I thought it was important that Arsenal signed Mesut Ozil because I thought it was, you know, something we could build on. But with hindsight, would we not have been better to let him go and invest the money that we paid his wages or paid on his wages into other players and younger players and everything else, you know, hindsight 2020, all that kind of stuff. Just don't be afraid to endure some short-term pain for what might be, you know, better off, better things in the long term.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I would love to think that we have learned those lessons, but I'm not entirely clear that we have.
I'm not entirely sure that we have, because obviously we've got some other ones. I think we should probably leave it there.
Okay.
Because we've been going a long time, and there's a lot to do today and things to get on with. And we do, of course, have a game tomorrow. We will have
soon.
Tomorrow. We will hopefully have a preview podcast for you a bit later on for Patreon members. Myself and Lewis will be doing something for you there. So join us for that. We'll see what we can do after the game as well on Wednesday. If there's something we can do there, we'll sort something out for that as well post Southampton. Fingers crossed for better at St. Mary's tomorrow night than we saw at the weekend. As ever, thank you for listening, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.